But yeah, so this is basically some pictures which will come up again. The one I won't have much time to go over is this one in the middle, and maybe I can take a few minutes, which actually sort of is more interesting to you.
Yeah.
So this is a picture taken in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and what you're seeing here are these channels. All right. So not all beaches have these channels, but let's say 10 to 20% have good channels, and this one was an excellent example of what we wanted to study, and it was amazing, and it was just it's very reproducible. If you go at the right time of the tide, you can see these channels, and what we were interested in here, if you can sort of squint, I think you can see that there is some kind of spacing to these channels. So we were interested in finding out where that wavelength comes from. So
Did you find
what we did was actually we made a box, say this big, and actually did a tabletop experiment, which where the table is this big, and we observed channels, and depending on the flow rate, which corresponds to the rate at which the tide goes out, for example, on the slope of the beach, you can get different looking channels. So the spacing could change, but I think what we concluded was it sort of coarsens forever. So what length scale you see it depends on when you stop or when the tide turns around or something like that. But there's this, as you may know, that there's this classic problem that there are, unlike river basins, which are considered fractal, the actual tributaries, the way they enter a river, tend to be periodic. It's not fractal. And so, or that's the folklore in geophysics. So in Andes, for example, it's every tens of kilometers. In this case, it's a foot, and so on. So, all right. So our attempt was to find out one example where we could figure out anything in that. Okay. So I think I'll step back and we'll get going. Right? It's 5 minutes after, so. Or is it 10 minutes?
No,
Different universities have different
five
rules. Five is a.
Ours is four. You can
I see. Well, yours is four. All right. So I think I'll get going. I think I want to keep to within an hour. Today I'm going to talk about experiments that we have done with particles which are not your average spherical particles. So that is the usual starting point of all granular experiments and even granular work which has been going on. But in this sort of hour, I will focus on the experiments that we have been doing where that is not the case. Okay? So just to clue you in to the rest of the talk, I have some pictures which give you a sense of what I'll be talking about. So the first part of my first part will be on these rod-like particles. All right? So instead of having spheres, we have rod-like particles which have an aspect ratio of, let's say, 10, but we vary that. And the question which we'll be asking would be, how does the shape come into the way the particles pack? As you can see here, they're well packed here, how they move, and so on. Okay? So that will be the first part. I'll skip this and I'll talk about that maybe at the last transparency. And then here, this would be another example of an anisotropic granular matter where the particles are magnetized, all right, and they like to line up behind each other just like little magnets. And in that case, we'll ask what are the various phases one observes, what are the differences from an ideal dipolar particles, which is a sort of simplest example of a ferrofluid. All right, so the experiments that I'll be talking about have been done at Clark University, and various people have contributed to this work. The most recent is Stefan Dorbolov, who was a visiting scientist from Liège, Dan Blair and Tony Nicu, who are graduate students who have since have graduated. And most importantly, I think, has been the impact of Dmitry Wolfson and Lev Smearing, who have not only contributed to most of the simulations I'll be talking about in this talk, but actually have contributed to the experiments. I mean, they have really initiated the experiments. They've asked us to do things which have really helped gain a better understanding. All right, so just I think I've already given you an overview of what I'll be talking about. So the first is going to be the impact of shape on the dynamics. I'll focus on dynamics more than packing, although I'll have a few slides on that at the beginning. I'll discuss some examples of vortices that we've seen, how you can use sort of a ratchets, for example, to explain what is going on. We'll look at a simplest example of an anisotropic particle, which is a diatomic particle, if you like. All right, and then I'll give you our own version of a robo bug, as opposed to a robo fly, robo snail, which people have come up with. Simplest example of getting directed motion out of a noisy signal. All right, and then I'll go on and show you some pictures at the end to sort of if you guys are interested in some of the other things that we do, we'll have an opportunity to discuss those in the next 2 weeks I'm here. All right. So the fact that geometry is important, at least from thermal systems, is very well known. All right. So in the experiments which were done with microscopes in the early 1910-20 with tobacco viruses and so on, showed that when you take particles and you look at them under the microscope, colloidal particles, for example, they tend to line up. All right. So these are examples of, say, even pneumatic crystals. So they are not randomly scattered, as one would think, as if you say just drop some toothpicks, they look random. But in fact, they look fairly ordered in these sort of thermal systems where particles get kicked around because of just temperature. All right. So then if you go on, and again, these terms will come into, I'll be using them sort of freely later on, so I just want to introduce them here in case you're not familiar. So you can see, this is well known by now, that you can see particles, if you just put them inside a container, will tend to order, all right? They'll order with the particles aligned in one direction. In this case, it's called a pneumatic state, all right? There can be further order where they not only align in a certain direction, but they also have a periodic stacking of these particles, all right? So this is called a synaptic state. All right. And these are seen, and this was explained by Onsager in 49 by introducing the entropy maximization principle. All right. So he, for example, said that, well, one may naively think that things, when they are randomly aligned, will be most disordered. But what happens is that if they are locally aligned, like this, then they actually have more freedom to move around. All right. So that you can rearrange them more often, and that actually maximizes the entropy even more. All right, so that is basically the principle behind why there is, by giving up one degree, by ordering in one sense, they actually become more disordered in other sense.
That, the entropy maximization leads to short-range order.
Well, this is long-range, right? It's just long.
But the argument which you say occurs leads to short-range order, not to long-range order.
So maybe I can step back and say it. So here, so if for example, these particles were randomly aligned, they would be jammed. You can't move them around that much. But if you just sort of give that up, okay, and locally they get sort of aligned in the same direction, then each, there is more space for them to move around. All right, so that way, so there are many more states they can explore. All right?
Yeah.
So that, right? So that is why, by giving up.
But it's not long-range order.
It is long-range order. It's
no. It's not periodic. It's not periodic in that direction.
So that is so. This is one example which is pneumatic, but in this case it is periodic. So.
What?
In this case, in the semantic state, you have a periodic signal even in this direction.
It's not clear that it's long-range, but in the other one, in the pneumatic state, it certainly isn't long-range.
Long-range order in the direction in which the particles are aligned, in the orientation. So in this case, there is orientational order in this direction for over hundreds of particles, it turns out. In this case, you can have not only orientational order in this direction, but also a periodic stacking. So you have all the particles aligned in this stacks for over many stacks. So you can get many or different kinds of ordered structures, and they have been seen.
So the first one just has order and
yeah, orientation.
The second one
yeah, so that's a pneumatic state,
position.
Right? Okay. So here they are aligned, but also stacked. All right. So if you were to draw the average density, it would be periodic, right? But within the plane, of course, they are not ordered. And then you can go on, and then that will be a colloidal crystal. Okay. So all those have been observed. All right, so the question is that, okay, in this case, thermal agitation basically kicks the particles around. The particles explore local phase space, and this is what they settle into. All right, so the question there one can ask is, if now you have friction between the particles, you have granular particles, what would happen? Okay, and the answer may or may not be well known. And again, you know, can you apply those ideas across? Right. So now, what is really known? What are the experiments, sort of typical experiments, which have been done with granular particles? So even though this experiment was not touted as being a granular particle experiment, where these people in Paul Chaykin's group and Sal Torquato's group looked at packings of M&M particles, oblate particles, ellipsoids, and so on, and then they concluded that for special ratios, all right, and actually M&Ms are pretty good examples, you get random packings which are even higher than for spherical particles. All right, so you get around 0.7 or so as opposed to 0.64. Okay, so here is another example where shape matters, all right, for the packing.
Can you just tell us why that is unusual, that is unexpected?
It's not unexpected, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think if you. Yeah, I mean, if you take the pennies, for example, right. But no. But random packing. This is not when you've stacked it.
Sure.
Okay. So by the algorithm, and I don't think it was expected. I mean, excuse me, it wasn't discussed as being a possibility until these people did simulations, where they actually took particles and squeezed it into a small region, and then they found the random packings had 0.7, even 0.74, depending on the ratio of the particles.
But then you have to define what you mean by random packing.
I think I'll step. I think we have the talk from Chaykin coming up in June.
In the uptake on why it is unusual.
No, it's not. I don't think it's unusual. It doesn't go under against my intuition.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting that they have demonstrated it. Right. Okay. So that's an example of packing where the shape matters. Okay. Then also, if you look back and when self-organized criticality was being discussed, where people took rice and did experiments with that, they found that there was some unusual avalanche dynamics. But what is interesting to me that you can show that there are much sort of locally 90 degree angles, for example, and so on. So shape does matter. Okay. So that's my point from this. From the slides. So now let's come to the sort of more recent experiments, all right, where people have started looking at packing. So the experiments which are done at Chicago were sort of like this, where they took essentially what's a test tube sort of geometry, put in a whole lot of plastic rods, and if once they started with something like this and shook it up and down, all right, then they saw something like this. Right. And if you look back at what I showed you earlier, this seems to best resemble what's called the semantic state. All right, so there is orientational order as well as they are stacked. Yeah.
In the case of the pneumatic system,
yeah,
you have that boundary condition have taken very far away,
yeah,
so
yeah,
there should have no effect.
Right.
Is the case here?
So yeah,
the grains have the same, for most the same size of the diameter.
Right. So the way Heinrich Jaeger's group sort of explained their observation was saying that, well, you have a tube which is being oscillated up and down. It shears the particles, and that shear sort of causes it, alignment. All right. So that the particles, again, instead they're like this, tend to align this way. And what they observe is actually from here. Can almost see it. I skipped a couple of the images in between, but the alignment starts at the boundary and propagates in. Okay.
So this may not be a sort of pneumatic transition or semantic in this case.
Yeah. So here,
boundary induced with orientation, the fact that the driving is not the boundary.
That may just be because the boundary is curved as well. Any cross section.
I think the main point is that this is small. the ratio is small. And if the question is what happens, so then the aspect ratio is large.
Is this a phase transition or just a path that we should observe because you have some strong effects at the boundary?
I think these are excellent questions to ask. And again, you know, the experiments is one is that, and then the question I can, and the experiments that we have done. So there's not a whole lot of experiments. Yes.
Yeah, I would just add that I'm not sure there's a fundamental distinction between them, since hard sphere liquids do exist in a finite geometry. I mean, the only energy, if you have non-interacting particles, the only energetic contribution can be from the walls. I'm not sure why you would exclude that as being real in the sense of producing a phase transition. It's finite size, but...
Yes, but maybe I can go on to the next slide, which might help. Okay. All right.
You will see that there is sort of organization in that direction, that this is not called phase transition for our sense. Instead, you call it phase transition the fact that the Randall and IC model at some point has magnetization, even if you have.
Mario, let me just interrupt and say, I don't mean to, I think it's great to have discussion, but I think the narrow question I can answer for you in the next slide, very soon after this, is the reason, is it because of boundary effects or not? I think the answer is probably no. Okay? And I think our experiments help. Yeah.
That it's not entirely boundary.
Yeah. Even though in their case it might be because of the boundary, boundaries are important. It's not necessarily true. Okay? And I'll come back to that in a second. So the experiment that we are doing is one in which sort of was inspired by talking to Seth Fraden was a wider geometry. All right, so we have rods which are half a centimeter long, but our containers are 8.5 centimeters or so. So many more grain diameters across. So wider containers, as you'll see in the movie shortly. All right. So the question we are asking is again, okay, some packing questions, but dynamics is the reason. Is there because of the way, because of their shape, is there some novel dynamics? Does the shape help drive the particles? That's the question. All right. And it will become clear in a few seconds what I'm saying. All right. So imagine we have a container which is literally that big when it's blown up there, and then we have put in about tens of thousands, 8 to 10,000 particles in there, and then we shake it up and down. All right, this should give you an intuition right away as to whether boundaries matter. So you can see that. So we are looking down on this container, which is being vibrated up and down. This is slightly speeded up. The whole movie lasts for about 4 minutes or so, but this takes about a minute to play. All right, so as you saw qualitatively, initially it looks sort of disordered, and at the end, it's ordered. Okay, I'll play this movie in a second describing some of the salient effects. But basically, what you're looking there at are so particles which are long this way, they're randomly aligned, they look this way. When they are pointing towards you, the tips are a little bit more shiny, and that's why they look brighter. Okay.
Is that actually all rotating there, or is that just
a
strobing effect?
Yeah. Okay. So initially we had some random packing just poured in. All right. And then as time went on, you saw localized regions of order appear. Just to go back to that, the question you were raising, and these ordered structures occurred everywhere, not just at the boundary. All right. So the orders it started getting more ordered. And then somehow there was a mobility, as you can see. And as you notice, there are these vortices which start appearing. OK?
How deep is the system? What the depth?
The depth essentially is such that when they are vertical, it's one rod deep. OK?
So you could say it's coming from the bottom boundary.
Excuse me?
You could say it's coming from the bottom boundary.
Yes. So. So in terms of the packing question, which I won't go in, if you keep increasing the number of layers, certainly up to 4 or 5 stacks, you can get stacks of particles, all right? But you don't see motion. And the motion has to give away the sort of what's going on. It comes from the boundary. Okay. So
what happens if you have less than one layer?
All right. So here, phase diagram. So before I answer that, just to finish up the stories, if you look at the vortex pattern itself, the pattern at the end, what you see is at the center, they're more or less vertical, and at the sides, they're inclined. All right? And by just looking at this, from my experience, I know that this vortex was turning this way. All right? So it turns out always that the rods are inclined in the direction of motion. Okay? And you can measure the angles and so on by some tricks. But coming to your question, so you can do a phase diagram. So you can shake a certain number of rods, which we will sort of denote by volume fractions when they are vertically packed. All right. So imagine you take this container, you take X number of rods, put it in there. So N of phi will be the fraction of rods which fill the container. So it's from 0 to 0.8. Okay.
Point. More than one would mean that you have more layers. More.
0.93, whatever will mean. In this way of drawing, 0.93, right, for disks, the backing, yeah.
So you mean the entire diagram is drawn in a region of less than one monolith?
Yes, yeah, all right. And here we are shaking with 0, 2 Gs, 4 Gs, and so on, all right? So now if you have a region where as soon as you overcome a certain number of particles, you get a large region in which you get this vortex motion. but if it is less than that, then you get what appears to look like a pneumatic state. Let me just show you some pictures. So here, for example, are the pictures corresponding to that phase diagram. So if you have a small number of particles, they essentially lie flat, all right? They seem to have some local order. They align in a certain direction, and then are little domains you can see here, all right? But then as one increases the volume fraction, even though it's not enough to stack them up all vertically, you start seeing small regions of vertically aligned or inclined, strongly inclined domains, which grow in size until you have large regions which are vertically aligned. All right, so it's strange, right? I mean, it's you think this is the most easiest place for it to rest, but somehow they prefer to be vertically aligned. All right. So as you keep increasing, then you get large regions where the rods are vertically aligned. All right. And then there are other regions where they are horizontal.
Are those pictures taken after the shaking has stopped?
These pictures are taken pretty much after everything has. These are taken after, let's say, 10 minutes of shaking. They'll be shaking at 60 hertz. And this is sort of the asymptotically.
Continuing while you're taking the picture, or
yeah,
it stop?
Yeah, and it won't matter, because as soon as you stop, within after a few collisions, everything comes to rest anyway. All right, so
you don't fall over.
No. They are, it's sort of. Yeah.
That's why I keep it.
Huh?
Steve.
That's why you had trouble finding stirrers today, right?
Based on your previous one.
Here?
If you change the shape.
Shape of the rods? Or
container, sorry.
Of the container, yeah.
Do you have the same behavior as a function of gamma?
Yes. So Seth Frayden's group, they haven't published it yet, but has done that. They have changed they made the boundary square. They made it rectangular. They've changed the aspect ratio of the rods, and it's pretty robust.
I used to say the transition from the heaping pneumatic to the horizontal vertical vortices is about gamma equal 2 dot something.
Yeah, you mean this transition is around 2.2, and I believe that that's also the same point at which, even if you have spherical particles, and if you shake, that's the point at which you, even in that case, go from sort of heaping-like behavior to getting some uniform patterns and so on. So I don't know why that magic number exists, but it might have to do with.
These transitions are robust to container shape and aspect ratios, and so.
I think you can say that
this is a phase diagram, not just a dynamical diagram.
of what happens to the rods.
I think the trends are robust, but I won't put too much faith into at what point it crosses. Yeah.
Because this is related to my question before on Chicago's experiment.
Yeah.
If this is a phase diagram in some sense, is a phase transition or something used by dynamics?
I think I don't know enough to answer that. I think that's the honest answer.
I'm wondering about the limit of small density.
Here?
Yeah.
Small density. When you have, okay, so.
You would expect that the something happens in a region around gamma equals 1.
So, okay, so you're asking somewhere here, right? So you have a few rods and then you shake. We haven't really explored that too much.
But your first data point is in the region of 0.0 something?
Right, I think that corresponds to basically 500 rods. That's what it is. Okay, let me step back and say I will explain or I will go into a scenario where you have few rods which do not interact with each other.
What does it sort mean of towards this,
towards
the container when they are nigh? I mean the smallest data point, yeah.
Yeah.
How much of the container is covered in this state?
So you're asking me.
The aspect ratio is 12, so yeah. It should be about 12.9 inch. So it's not covered in the lowest state.
So here, these points over here essentially start corresponding to something like this. Okay.
The container is covered completely.
It's covered monolayer flat.
It's right? More than a monolayer, you see that.
Yeah, but this is 0.15, right? A little bit more, not much more. Okay. But I will go into the case where you have simple rods sort of isolated from each other in a different context. So I'm starting with the most complicated system, and I'm sort of actually presenting it like historically, though this is the way we approached it, made it simpler and simpler and simpler. All right? So that's what I'll do. Okay. Because I think it works better. All right, so then you can ask me questions like, all right, if you were shaking it horizontally versus vertically, all right, would this system order or not? All right, so again, in this case, so we are taking the same container, shaking it horizontally, these are the same parameters over here. Even in this case, you see domains of vertical rods, which are similar in fraction as of the whole container as in the other case. Right, so you see something like this. So you see domains of vertical rods, even in this case, you can rattle it instead of shaking it vertically or horizontally. And in all these cases, you see vertical domains. But you do not see vertices in this case. Right? Okay, so here's my sort of hand-waving argument as to why the rods fall in vertically. Okay, so imagine you have some kind of disordered system. You can pack a rod, or a rod can fall in more easily this way than in this direction, all right? And when it does that, it lowers its center of mass, all right? And that basically means that once you're in that scenario, you don't hop out of it that easily, which is sort of gives rise to, vertical domains, provided there are enough of them to help them stand up, all right? So that's why if you have only a few rods, then they sort of sit flat, but as soon as you start increasing the number of rods, then this rod, for example, finds it easy to just fall into this crack in between the rods, and that's the reason, I think, why they align vertically, all right? We have actually Tony did this. He actually laid all the rods horizontal. It took a while to do that, and then within a few shakes, it was all vertical. So it is quite robust, this.
I mean, what about another argument? For placing a particle in a vertical position, you need the coherent motion of less other particles than if you want to place it this way.
Yes, so if you ask what is the hole size distribution, mm-hmm. So you have fewer, larger small holes, right? So that way you can fit in a particle this way more easily than in this way.
Okay,
it's the same argument. So that's why I think, that's why it's not anything different than the why Brazil nuts go up. It's just the same void filling mechanism. All right, so one can sort of go into growth rates and so on, but I think I will skip that. And then come to the dynamics. So why do these rods move?
Okay, so this is the summary of the growth rate of domains.
So you can describe it using some simple equation. All right, so.
And what do alpha and beta mean?
They're just fitting parameters. All right, so beta actually means this is the maximum number of rods
when
vertical. Okay, and that is not a derived quantity. That is what we observe. So that makes it switch off to zero, and that basically gives rise to this form.
Marsha, please speak. It's noisy here.
Sure. Okay.
Speak up.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
This is an equation which is believed to
Right. So let me step back and describe. I was going to skip this. So this is the number of vertical rods versus time. Okay. And the different colors here mean different volume fractions. All right. So in all cases, so if you have a small number of rods, it's this. When you have a large number of rods, it is something like this. All right. And we can describe that by this simple equation, where the rate of change of the vertical rods is proportional to the number of vertical rods, and it switches off as the number of vertical rods goes as everything becomes vertical, right? So using that, you can describe the growth of the vertical domains. That's all we are saying.
Is this supposed to be just a data fitting, or is it supposed to be really
So you can sort of motivate it by this kind of scenario qualitatively, yeah. But it's experimentalist theory, right? So yeah. Okay.
As you can say, you need to have vertical rods in a part in an area in order to align other rods vertically. And
right.
The second term is just a sort of spherical effect. At least if you have too many,
Yeah. Right. The rate has to go to zero when everything becomes vertical.
Just, yeah,
that's all it says.
It's not when everything's vertical.
Sorry?
Some fraction is vertical.
When some fraction is vertical. All right. That's why I said beta is a fitting. I don't have a. Okay. So let me sort of go to the more. The purpose of this talk, which is the dynamics. So why do these rods move? Okay, so that was a question. So if you actually did particle tracking, so this is an image with a velocity field overlaid on it. You see all the particles moving around in circles. The velocity basically from here you can see increases and then decreases as one goes to the side. All right. So what we are going to do is this is too hard for us to explain. And what we are going to do is we're going to just use a ring of rods. Okay? So instead of trying to explain this, all right, so this is quite easy to see. So you have a whole bunch of particles here, and you can almost see it. It's not great. It's not as good as some of the other demos, but in 5 minutes, this is the demo I came up with. But if you shake this, all right, this does move around in circles. All right? It works better with toothpicks inside. A container, but this is too hard to analyze. And what we are going to just do is because, as I showed you earlier, they all form fairly ordered structures. We are just going to use a ring of these rods, and look at what happens. Okay. So instead of having the hole, so this is a simplification now that we are doing. So instead of having a whole container filled with rods, we're going to have an annulus filled with rods. All right. So, and then let us just put in, this happens to be Teflon particles, all right, something very different. And then let us shake them vertically. All right. So here, as you can see, it goes nicely to the left as they incline in this direction. All right, and the second dam is going to switch the direction, and under the same conditions, it's going to the right because it's inclined. All right, and if you keep adding number of particles, pack them up more, and they're essentially vertical, right? But they're not jammed. You can just take a stick and you can move them. All right, they don't move anywhere. All right, so basically, doing this, we can show that inclination is very important to the whole thing. All right. So one, again, measures the speed at which they move versus the inclination of the rods, okay? And the way we change the inclination of the rods is just by putting more or less number of particles. We find a sweet spot. So the first, the as one inclines the rods further and further from vertical, the speed increases, reaches a maximum, and then goes down.
Is that related to the friction angle or the friction of the particles?
Between the particles or?
Well, the shape.
So yeah, so I'll explain that a little bit more because we have Lev's help for that. That's why. Okay. So in this, and just to give you a picture of what happens again, as one shakes harder, you get forward motion most of the time as a function of inclination. But there's this tiny regime. All right. There's a tiny regime. There's actually a reverse motion. So just after you've gotten comfortable that. Saying that particles always go into that forward direction, there's a tiny regime where there's actually a slow reverse motion. Okay, so, all right. So how do you sort of explain this? So, sort of said, well, this is sort of we can't turn friction off in our examples that easily, so we'll do a simulation, and that's where Dimitri came up with a very clever algorithm to simulate rod motion. All right, so that I think it's one of the first ones to do it, where basically by matching all the frictions and so on, he did a simulation, and where, again, as you see, it moves in the forward direction or in direction of inclination with the right speeds. All right, so.
And then if there's no friction, how can they gain any angular momentum?
There is friction. Did I say there's no friction?
Oh, sorry, I thought that was mistaken.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I mean, in the experiment, I understand that you can gain angular momentum, but in the simulation, how do you gain angular momentum here?
So here, okay. So I should say a few words about the simulation. So the simulation assumes that there is friction between the rods, there's friction between the rods and the sidewalls, and there's friction between the rods and the bottom plane. All right. And they not only that, they have to assume static friction and kinetic friction. So that is, the aging of the contacts is also important in the simulation to get this the speeds correct. All right. So let me just so in the simulations, what they can do, which we can't do that easily, is they can change the friction between the rods and the wall. All right. And when they do that, the speeds increase. So as they decrease the friction, the speeds increase. But on the other hand, if they change the friction between the rods and the bottom surface, okay, then speeds decrease. All right, so using the simulations, at least, it's clear that what is crucial is the interaction of the rod with the bottom plate. All right, so that is just using the steps, we made it a little bit easier to understand where the motion could be coming from. Okay, so there is a simple way of demonstrating this, is that if, for example, I'll maybe drop a pen, all right? So if you drop a pen on a plate, all right, okay, usually it spins in the direction of the inclination. All right, so, okay, all right, so you can do this with various objects which are not spherical, they'll always spin in that direction, all right? So that is basically the crucial point which we use to now explain why the rods move. So if you have a rod now, okay, which is now in contact with the bottom plate, now you have to consider the equations of motion for this, all right? So you have the weight of the particle that you have to consider, but then you have to consider the friction that the rod, all right, has with the plate, okay? So as you can imagine, if a rod is falling, it the tendency is for it to slide forward. All right, so the friction holds you back, right? Okay, so that friction here is in this direction, in the x direction, as the way I've drawn it, all right? So that prevents this end from sliding, you can imagine. In the best case scenario, it's stuck, all right? And then the rod spins ahead, right? The center of mass keeps falling, so it has to spin ahead. So that gives an effective velocity in the horizontal direction for the rod. Okay, and as it collides with the rest of the particles, it loses that forward energy, and you can argue in that way that that's where the horizontal velocity comes from. Okay, it basically comes from the fact that the rod hits the bottom plate, there's a frictional interaction between the tip of the rod and the base plate, and that rotates the rod. Okay? And that gives it a horizontal speed, and you can derive this formula. I won't go into even writing down the formula because it's so long that it depends on the inelastic collision, epsilon, depends on the friction, mu between these two rods, okay, and then the inclination of the rod.
This would mean that you can change the velocity of the particles by changing the friction between the particles. Can you do that? Is it true?
Between the particles?
Yeah.
Yes, one can, but in the simulations we have done that,
can
but
you
not.
Invert even the direction by changing the friction.
Can we invert the direction?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. Okay, but basically, even while considering the collision between this and the plate, there are three different scenarios you have to consider. One is that the rod is going forward. It's always going to slip on the surface as it goes forward. All right. The other scenario is that it slips, sticks, all right, during the collision. Or the third scenario is that it slips and reverses direction as it bounces off. So there are three different scenarios that you have to consider while considering the collision of this rod with the plate, all right? And that becomes important in explaining that velocity versus angle curve that I showed you, all right? So here is the simulations that Dimitri did for the speed as a function of the angle, all right? And the circles is what he got, all right? And in this simulation, what he has done is taken away the sidewalls to make the calculation easy. And in that situation, they can do the calculations for three different scenarios, as I said. One when it's slipping forward, one when it's slipping forward, then stops. The other one, while it's colliding, it slips forward, stops, and reverses. Those are the three legs of that, and it falls all right.
Arshad, what determines which one happens in a given collision?
So what happens depends on the angle of contact. So you can imagine when it's falling essentially vertically like this, there's not much slip, all right? So it slips.
It has to do with whether the static friction is exceeded.
Yes, yeah, so that's right.
They use conventional friction law.
They use conventional friction law, all right? For this experiment, all right, when I discuss the dimer, which will come in a few minutes, we have to actually use aging of the contacts also to do it correctly. Okay. So, but anyway, so here, this is this. So what we could do here was basically Dimitri could do was do a model, do a 2D simulation, all right, and then put in wall frictions, and we could see the same form for the speed versus angle as the experiment. And the reason why we can't directly compare these two is because we left out the collisions with the other particles. All right, and that is a very hard calculation. And so this was satisfactory, but you want to do better. So what we did was, okay, so this is what Alev asked me to do. So, okay, he said, well, we are doing a problem in which we are considering just the collision of a single rod with a plate, bouncing on a plate. So why don't you do that experiment? All right, so going from tens of thousands of rods, you come down to a few tens in the previous example, now to just one, all right? Okay, so that should be easier, right? We thought it would be a undergraduate project, but it turned out to be a much more complicated project than that. All right, so now consider, so instead of a rod, all right, I'm going to consider a dimer. And the reason for that I'll give you in a second. All right, so imagine it's one of the particles. It just has some angular momentum, right? And we put it on the plate and we vibrate it. That's what we're going to do. All right, and the reason why we decided to do it with a dimer rather than a rod is because with a rod, we never know where it's actually contacting. It has its vibrational modes, and it makes it very hard for us to detect where the collision is occurring and so on. And for that reason, we just went with a dimer or a diatomic particle, okay? So this is sort of a problem which is, I think, interesting in its own right, right? This is like a bouncing ball problem, but now with a more complicated problem of two particles. So this is, as that movie played, you sort of, you know, again, that's what you would think would happen. It would just bounce randomly. In that case, what happened was it was bouncing, both the ends were bouncing on the plate in phase, during in this, and whereas in this case the so-called Fluttermore, they collide every other period. Okay, so for example, we can
stiff connection between the spheres.
Sorry,
the connection in the spheres.
It's a stiff connection. That's right. So what? So let me take a second. So these spheres are 3 millimeter particles, all right, or 0.5 millimeter particles. We've done with different sizes, and we have glued them together either directly or with a short stiff glass rod. Okay, and in this case, I think he has Stefan has glued a little black jacket on it for imaging purposes. All right, that's it. But it's basically a stiff rod. All right, you can again ask how stiff is stiff, but it's essentially a stiff rod. All right, so you can by using these sort of carefully chosen rods, you can actually particles. You can track the position of the particles. And so this is, for example, the first one I showed you, the Fluttermore, where the particle hits, the one end of the dimer hits every other period, okay? The other one, which I showed you, was the jump mode, where they hit essentially every time, maybe not exactly at the same phase, but once every period, okay? But then, this was a surprise, all right? So this is the highest energy mode. You can calculate that very easily, all right? This is the third highest energy mode. This is the second highest energy mode, and this is the ground state, the first excited state, okay? So in this case, one of the rods bounces, ends of the rods bounces, or the dimer bounces, but the other end is essentially stays on the plate, okay? So let me show you what that is. Okay, all right? So this is a close-up of the dimer. So what Stefan does is essentially just drops it many, many times. And in fact, this, which is the first excited state, is the most often observed state. Okay. So here you can see one end is bouncing, and the other end is essentially on static on the plate, except that it bounces off a little bit just after it turns out, after this end hits. Okay, so this is in essentially 1D, where we have two glass plates in front and back of this, confining it to 1D, just for imaging purposes. But on the movie on the right, you see that you can do this in 2D too. And we have just added a little wire so that it doesn't roll. But you see it's pretty robust. It will go in the direction that you set it off in, and after it collides also it can sustain and move. All right, so this is sort of again very different, I think. All right, so this is where the ratchet came in, or noise driven motors came in, is that this is very different than these classic examples of noise driven motors. So you have a granular particle in that case in an asymmetric potential. All right, then in this case, if you oscillate it vertically like this, then it's observed, all right, that this ball will move in this direction, all right? So the idea is that, well, it gets kicked up randomly most of the time, but then when it hits something like this plane here, it's going to get a kick more often in this direction, or it will just fall down this direction, and that will result in a net horizontal drift in this longer direction, okay? So that's the classic example where the substrate is prepared, all right? And the ball or any particle is sort of just bounces randomly, all right? So again, to explain this, in the last 10 minutes, again, you have to, it's a very complicated mechanics problem, all right? Where one has to look at the collision of this dimer on this plate, all right? And what is, so you have to consider Newton's laws now, again, as usual. You have to consider the stick slip, whether this end is going to slip or stick, giving the three different scenarios I gave you already for the rod case. This is continuous slide, slip stick, or slip reversal. But then, in this case, there's something more, all right?
What do you mean by slip reversal? I didn't catch that.
So I'm just drawing a ball here, all right? Yeah, okay, so this is moving in this direction. All right, so during the contact, all this three scenarios are during the contact, okay? So the ball is moving forward, all right? But then it can come to a stop, but because of what is happening to the rest, All right, because this because it's spinning around the center of mass, this will actually go backwards. All right, so that is, so you can imagine all three scenarios are possible, where it just continues to go forward during the collision, and that collision lasts microseconds, so much less than that, as far as we could tell. It was smaller than our measurements, or it can slide forward, stop. All right, or it can go backward. But then, in addition to these three, which is complicated enough, all right, you have to consider double collisions, what we call as double collisions, where this ball is in contact, all right, but this other ball comes and hits too. All right, so, okay, so that is to say, we have this here, and the second ball also is in contact. So you have a collision, of, so there's one contact here, and the second contact here.
This analysis, assuming the collisions are instantaneous, pretty much. Not quite, no.
Because we had to, as I'm telling you, we have to put in all three scenarios.
Yeah, but I mean, they're still extremely short. You ever actually get them both in contact?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And in fact, if you don't do it right, the dimer ends up going in the wrong direction. If you do it a very dirty calculation, which is what we try to do first, the dimer ends up going in the wrong direction more often than not. And in fact, you don't put tangential friction, you don't get any motion, of course, right? Mm-hmm.
But this would mean, you know, as they got stiffer and stiffer, there'd be less chance of the contact happening simultaneously, so you'd expect it to change. It's very...
As you saw, again, I don't have the movie, but as you saw, what happens is that, and I think I don't have, this particle is almost always in contact, okay? And so this, this is always in contact. It seems to jump here, all right? That little jump happens right after this hits, this end hits. So when this end is hitting, this is in contact, all right? And these are not, these are so-called double collisions. These are nothing unusual. If you have two on a substrate, all right? If you have on a substrate two particles which are rolling and colliding, that's a simple example of a double collision, where you have a contact, all right, contact here and a contact here. So double collisions are nothing.
The question is, do you just use an impulse approximation for the collisions?
Yes, all right. But the friction that one puts in is slightly different depending on if it's a long contact like this or.
What I'd say is in the first case where it's actually continuously in contact, it's not a collision. So I wouldn't really say it's a double collision. But
during the collision, there are two contacts.
Yeah, okay, yes, there are two contacts, but it's not that one of the particles is already in contact when the other collides. It's not a double collision, but it's a collision while there's contact. It's not a process.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be logic. I mean, the second one should take off before the first one comes down.
So again, in the double collisions, again, it becomes complicated enough that you have to consider all three scenarios. Double slide, so as it hits, it's going forward. While it's going forward, it might stop or it might reverse, all three possibilities. So there are eight different scenarios for the collision which one has to consider, and one has to consider it very correctly. All right, if you try to do again a dirty calculation. So this is just the first page of 10 pages of calculations, which is sort of first year graduate school, I guess. You go through the whole calculation, and then basically what one can do is feed that. You don't get a simple, nice form for the speed, but you can actually put it into an event-driven simulation, if you like, where you're just propagating the solutions. And this is what Dimitri finds and Lev find, that for the same, using the same conditions, gamma, again, is less than one in this case, frequency 25 hertz, and the same aspect ratio, putting in the same friction coefficients between the two, the rods, and the plates that we measure, all right, you can get the same speeds, all right, provided you take into consideration all these single, double collisions correctly. And as I said, you get the directly opposite situation if you don't do it.
This
event-driven? It's not it's not right to call it an event-driven simulation. It's basically the solutions of the equation.
I mean, if you make event-driven, then only one particle can be in contact with the flow at the same time.
It's basically what I mean by event-driven is that imagine you have now one end in contact, then you use the equations of motion, write down the solution, and then when there are two, then you solve the corresponding equation. So it's not quite right to call it event-driven simulation, right? But you have to, event-driven is much more complicated than continuous, than molecular dynamics. So if you do a simple molecular dynamics, it's not that easy. Aspect ratio. Okay. So again, here, as in the previous case, if you change the aspect ratio, all right, you can get different speeds. I shouldn't say as the previous case, but basically, as one changes the aspect ratio of how far the two particles are, the two ends of the dimers are, the speed decreases as one increases the speed. Aspect ratio, you actually get a small regime in which the rod goes backwards. All right? Because of the relative strengths of... So let me... I think I didn't give you a hand-waving argument as to why it was observed. All right? So the idea, the way we explain this whole thing is that you have a dimer which is colliding with the plate, there is a rolling collision, so it rolls forward, all right, and then on the way up, it slips, all right, as it spins around the center of mass. So depending on the rolling forward versus slipping backwards as it spins up, competition between the two, you get different speeds going forward versus backwards. So that's the sort of hand-waving argument which comes out of all the calculations.
So I would suggest if it was extremely high friction, it wouldn't happen.
So friction does enter into the calculations, yes. Okay, so again, this mode is pretty robust. As you can see, you can make this dimer climb a hill if up to 3 or 4 degrees or so, but it's strong enough. You can get downward motion or upward motion depending on the aspect ratio and the tilt angles. Okay. So here, in this example which I was showing you, we have essentially a symmetric case, right, where both particles were spheres of the same kind. They were steel particles, or you have used Teflon particles and so on. But then you can make this whole system even more robust, all right, by considering asymmetric dimers. So I think I should wrap up here very quickly. So supposing you now make a dimer out of a steel ball and a glass bead. Okay, and put it on a plate, and then shake it, pretty hard. It turns out, you can get a directed walk. All right, so this is our RoboBug. All right, so again, there's no special preparation of the substrate by just cooking the particle appropriately, by using a steel heavy particle versus a glass particle, you get directed motion. You can see the lighter particle hops more. Okay. If one uses an aluminum and steel, get the same effect. So this is the steel particle, and this is the aluminum particle, in this case, walks to the right. The first indication is that the mass ratio of the two particles is very important in this kind of asymmetric particles, and we are sort of exploring this further. Okay, so I think I'm completely running out of time, so I think I'm going to skip through this whole magnetic particles stuff, and which some of you may have already seen. So I'm going to just take a few minutes, just in case some of you are interested in some of the other experiments that we do. So we are working on wet granular material, where we are interested in finding out what is the maximum angle at which the material fails, for example. More recently, we are trying to understand what is the dynamic angle one gets in a rotated drum as one rotates with different speed. So how does the fact that there's a little bit of liquid between the particles changes the rheology of the system? So we are studying that. in a series of, experiments. We are studying erosion patterns where we have essentially a geophysical system in a sandbox. So this is roughly a meter wide and long, 1 meter long, where we are using water as it sweeps through a granular wedge to study the channels which are eroded here. This is a project with Dan Rothman. And what we are doing here, which is something you can't do in the field, is we can actually measure the depths of these channels as a function of time completely. Okay. So there are some other experiments that we do on crumpling and so on. That if you are interested in, I'm here for the next 2 weeks. If not, well, I will see you in June and talk about the last part, which is on dense granular flows. All right. So I'll stop and take any questions. Yes. So for this case, what we have is, if you look at it from the side, all right. So we have a box essentially, which is this big, with a wedge of granular material. If you look at it in a cross section, we have a wedge of granular material, and we have an inlet. All right, and then we fill up water to a certain height, h, and so the water seeps through from an inlet at the bottom and through the granular material. All right, so that is happening somewhere inside here, and so if you look at it from the top, then it looks essentially like this, with this point here being somewhere here. All right, and then as a function of time. And as a function of height h, one gets patterns, erosion patterns developing. So there are these channels which develop. There are many to begin with, and as a function of time, they coarsen. And then, for example, in this case, there are four channels left. And what we are doing right now is just focusing on one of these channels and asking, how does this channel grow? That is to say, how fast does it get deep and versus wide? How do you describe the shape of this channel as a function of the pressure and various conditions, slope, and so on? So yeah, so it's a so-called example of a seepage-driven pattern, so where the water seeps through the granular media as opposed to just sort of rainfall falling and creating erosion patterns. Those are different. This is a slightly different class of problems.
The development of the rotation in your first experiments is very much like what happens in 2D turbulent systems, that it starts off completely disordered and ends up with one big vortex. But I mean, this is driven by the outside boundaries and it's very different in the square circuit. So it's not the same, but it always very different, but it looks very similar.
I guess these are vortex patterns, I guess. So
you can,
right. But I think here, the vorticity comes from the fact that if these were spherical particles, you would not see this at all. It's basically because these are anisotropic grains or rod-like particles. When they collide, you get a certain direction. And when you're inside a confined region, basically you have things following each other. And it forms a giant vortex.
So in a symmetric two-ball bag system, and you plot the speed.
Yes.
And you find some reason it's moving in the bubble injection.
Right. Right.
How do you explain that?
So you're asking. Right, so in this small region here, essentially really for one set of parameters, it turns out it goes backwards in a very small, with a very small speed. Okay, the magnitudes are very small. So again, the hand waving argument I can give you is the way it moves forward. So one end is hopping, bouncing, right? So it rolls forward, all right? And then as it gets hit, as this gets hit, because the plate is hitting it, it rotates. Goes up, it rotates about the center of mass, all right? Because there's a different amount of normal force on it in the upward direction as it rolls forward, versus while it's going down, it spins around the center of mass. When it's spinning around the center of mass, it is sliding for, it's sliding backwards, okay? And when it's rolling, it's going forward. So depending on the competition between the two, we get a motion, net motion forward versus backwards. So the point is given by the friction, it seems.
So uh-huh. That diagram, you change the amplitude of the drive. What is A?
Is the aspect ratio. Yeah, and this point, at least in the calculation here, the aspect ratio comes out to be inverse of the friction. So 1 over 5 is the friction.
It's still in the same mode where one of the particles is on the surface for most of the time.
Yes, yeah.
The mechanism just has been one good thing that the aspect ratio wouldn't be that important. It's just a matter of rescaling lengths.
The problem is that it's not completely the one of the rods
shaking or something like that. Maybe if you change the shaking, it's threshold.
So one of the amplitudes is actually well given by just gravity. Okay, the fact that the ball has to go up and return every period decides how much it has to go up and back. All right, and so the relative. So you imagine if it is small, it does this. Right, versus long does smaller, because this length that goes up is always the same, because it has to go up and return back in 1 over t.
The aspect ratio is not a real parameter, yeah. I mean, there should be two dimensional groups, one to do with the rotation, one to do with the acceleration relative to gravity, and one to do with the relationship between the turning, the moment of inertia, the turning velocity, frequency.
It'll come in because.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
It moves besides the angle, and the angle besides the.
No, but what's the aspect ratio?
The aspect ratio is the moment of inertia. It comes in that way.
Yeah, I know, but the aspect, it's defined in terms of the length of the ball, so it shouldn't actually matter.
No, could you repeat that? I missed the first part.
The aspect ratio, if you make the ball smaller on the end,
it doesn't really
change anything. So the aspect ratio, I mean, this is the length of your thing compared to the ball diameter.
Right, and the way we are changing that is by changing the length of the rod, right? Because we wanted to actually keep the mass the same, actually. So the glass density is much smaller, so.
Mass is okay.
It shouldn't matter, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So sort of a general question. Mm-hmm. From all of this, what is the general principles that you have to put into dynamical models for asymmetric systems as opposed to spherical systems?
So it seems to me that when you have these aspherical particles, you get the angular momentum becomes very important, and it comes in and couples into even flows, translation flows. So you get generically directional motion in these aspherical particles, right? I mean, I've shown you rods, I've shown you dimers. I guess Jerry has shown chiral particles. So you get, as soon as you go from spherical particles away from spherical particles, there's a large coupling between the shape and global flow in the system.
I think one could,
which is very important,
can be traced to a misalignment of the principal axes at the moment of inertia tensor of the particles with respect to the axis of the driver, the vertical, in these systems. So in Arshad's case, that misalignment happens because the particles are tilted at the moment of collision as a result of their interactions with neighbors often.
Or by themselves. But basically,
basically,
when you have gravity, which sets a direction, and if you have a collision, then
In the case of the chiral particles that we study, the misalignment happens because the particles are designed in such a way that when they're in contact with the plate, they cannot be sitting in such a way that the principal axes of the particle are aligned along the vertical, mm-hmm. but none of them can be aligned. It's just the geometry of the particles that are just built in. But I think all of these phenomena depend on that idea, I think. Whereas for a spherical mm-hmm. particle, there's no question about that.
Go ahead.
No, if you write an equation for a pneumatic system, you have all those.
Right. For a thermal, but there's no global motion there, right?
Yeah.
There's no global. In these cases, there is always.
Yes. Yeah, so you get. How do you modify the Leslie-Erickson coefficients, for example?
What coefficient?
The Leslie-Erickson.
We are not familiar with that.
Could you expand, speak a whole sentence, so that I actually understand what this question is. You write a constitutive relation for a pneumatic liquid crystal
yeah. as opposed to a liquid or spherical particles. You get asymmetric viscosity tensors. So the question is, that is there something more in this system which cannot be described by those kinds of models, which incorporate the local directionality explicitly?
But that is for a pneumatic crystal, right?
It's for a pneumatic
crystal. It's a bulk crystal. It's a continuum model, whereas I think what Arshad is doing is specifically for...
No, yeah, I agree. But does this give us some sense of what additional has to be put in? I mean, after all, in real applications, you want to use bulk models. If you're filling rice grains in a silo or something like that, but you want to be able to use a bulk model to describe that.
Right. I mean, so for example, even when you're filling rice, and we sort of try to, when we were trying to estimate the friction coefficients, we played with this idea. If you put a whole bunch of rods or rice particles inside a container and you rotate, you get this directional alignment, especially in the shear layer.
Right.
And
again, they're
moving and then they're colliding in gravity. So
yeah, it's a logical question. I guess what you're asking is, if, for example, if you're using a continuum model of a system like this, do you have to change the boundary conditions in some way?
That's one thing. The other thing is, I mean, you have to incorporate flow alignment in some way. Because in a pneumatic liquid crystal, if you go below the phase transition, the direction is set by it's sort of random direction.
Yes.
Whereas here, the direction is being driven by the flow somehow.
By the flow, and even when there is no flow, by gravity.
Yeah.
You know, in the first example where they were vertically aligned.
Right.
For example, you know, Sam Edwards in the first papers that he did about powder compaction applied it to granular rods also, but the alignment was all directions, right? But there is first gravity, which makes it different than a pneumatic crystal.
That's one thing. The other thing is there's this Brazil nut effect, right, effectively.
It seems. Yeah, that's the only way to explain why they are vertical. And the second is that you get this global convection, which comes from the anisotropy of the particles. So there is some feeding of energy into the global modes from the anisotropy.
The proper boundary condition at a boundary would be that you have alignment, but you have slip, for example, as opposed to spherical particles where you have no slip in some situations.
But it's more complicated than that, right? It says that the alignment of the rod relative to the surface somehow decides the translational direction of motion.
Well, have you done any experiments on bulk motion of these anisotropic? I guess you could say that you.
No, the first one. The first one is exactly that. But you can ask. So there are some people more recently who have taken a whole lot of rods, and put it inside a shaker and shook it. And then they see convection patterns in these rod-like particles where the rods are, again, aligned in the direction of the convection, if I remember correctly. I think this is in either on CONMAT or FISREVI. Mm-hmm.
Did Aronson and Simbering make a continuing model?
Yes. Vortex? Yes. Right.
Kumar's question.
Right. So that's what they first did, actually.
You didn't really describe that here.
No, because I don't have a physical intuition that I can.
They did have a field model.
They had a field, yeah, Ginsburg-Landau type of model where I can give you the reference for it, perhaps. It's in.
Can you give us some more insight into Ginsburg?
No.
Ginsburg-Landau is a standard model.
I know. Yeah. But what does the order parameter correspond to physically in these systems?
So here it is probably the inclination. Probably the inclination of the rods is the order parameter they use, and then in their model they explain why such a system of rods would coarsen. They just put in ad hoc a term that a rod will move in a certain direction if it is inclined in that direction, and by putting that this coarsening and this vortex formation in this sort of phenomenological model, but there were some differences. If you actually sketch the velocity as a function of distance from the center, they were not quite the same. But there are some phenomenological models, global models there. But then I think the rest of our where we took off was trying to really find out the mechanism by which they move.
I think Kumran is saying he would. I think you would find it interesting to look at the that model and to relate it to the conventional elastic description of
pneumatically. Well, absolutely. Yeah, that paper exists. So, yeah. That paper exists. I mean, it's published. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know if they actually did it in this. If they actually took this step.
Yeah,
that Kumran suggested. I don't think
they
did. I think it was purely
phenomenal.
Right.
No, but in liquid crystals, you can go from the parameters in the Landau-Ginsburg model to the elastic parameters by doing coarse graining explicitly.
That
is, if you know the free energy functional for the order parameter field, you can go to the macroscopic description.
This works in equilibrium or closed equilibrium when you give Ginsburg-Landau
theory in the system, so you can always write a Landau-Ginsburg theory. I mean, or can be skeptical about it, but it does give you patterns. Okay, so let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.